listening to Decisive Point. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the authors and are not necessarily those of the Department of the Army, the U.S. Army War College, or any other agency of the U.S. government. Andrew Payne is joining me virtually today from London. Payne is a lecturer in foreign policy and security at City University in London, a non-resident fellow at the Institute for Global Affairs, and a research associate at the University of Oxford. He's the author of The Politics of Restraint in the Middle East, which you can read in the spring 2024 issue of Parameters. Welcome to Decisive Point, Andrew.
Thanks. It's great to be with you.
How has the war between Israel and Hamas reignited debate over the appropriate size and scope of U.S. commitment to the Middle East?
Well, I think until recently, this notion that blood and treasure had been invested disproportionately in a region of declining strategic importance had been emerging as really the new conventional wisdom. We've now had three successive presidents elected on a platform of doing less in the region, and to varying degrees, they've all sought to divert resources and attention towards other political priorities, notably those in Asia. But what I think events since October 7th have done is challenge some of the assumptions upon which that course correction was based and triggered a renewed division among scholars and policymakers about the wisdom of that shift. So on one hand, some have characterized the current conflict as definitive proof that this idea that the US can pull back without leaving chaos in its wake is an illusion or a myth. And on the other hand, you've had commentators worry that the administration's response to the crisis could herald a return to the bad habits of bloated force postures and costly entanglements in regional conflicts. I think we're all focused on this short-term task of finding a resolution to the current crisis and managing the escalation risks. But in the months and years ahead, I do think we can expect a resurgence of this debate about the underlying commitment to the region.
You make a case for doing less in the Middle East. Please expand on this for me.
What I'm really interested in doing here is explaining some of the barriers to strategic adjustment. And for that reason, I focus on one side of the argument, which is the case for change, and in particular, the case for adopting a more restrained posture. And this taps into a broader debate about US grand strategy, in which advocates of restraint or retrenchment are heavily critical of the approach that the US has pursued since the end of the Cold War, which they refer to as liberal hegemony or military primacy. And for them, US involvement in the Middle East over the past two decades really serves as a case study of the flaws of that broader approach. We've seen efforts to promote democracy, human rights, and other liberal values in Iraq, Syria, Libya, and elsewhere. And scholars of restraint generally judge these to have been costly and mostly ineffective. I think it's important to point out that restrainers aren't isolationists. They do generally concede that the US has an interest in maintaining a favorable balance of power in the Persian Gulf, but they're skeptical about the utility of force postures in which that balance is preserved through a forward deployment of significant numbers of US troops. They'd rather stay offshore and let local forces shoulder that burden. They think the US should redefine a more limited range of core interests, reduce the reliance on military intervention, and retrench the overall military presence in the region. And that is something that I think most restrainers agree has not yet occurred, at least to the degree that they believe is required. The first thing I try to do in the article is to look back at the historical record and really assess the degree to which those complaints are warranted.
How did the Obama administration embrace the logic of restraint?
It's a bit of a mixed picture. It was very clear that Obama was intent on embarking on at least some degree of retrenchment. He was, of course, a very early opponent of the war in Iraq. He very frequently referred to the need to focus on nation building at home. But if you actually look at his public statements once in office, as well as the strategic guidance documents issued by his administration, the ends of US policy in the Middle East remained really quite expansive. And he wasn't afraid to use military force. He did bring an end to the war in Iraq, but troops were soon back there fighting against the Islamic State. He increased the commitment to the good war in Afghanistan. He authorized airstrikes and supported regime change in Syria and Libya. And in his last year in office, the US dropped 26,000 bombs on six countries alone. And I think if you also look at the data on the distribution of troop numbers within CENTCOM's area of responsibility, you also see this kind of mixed picture emerge. Troop numbers overall declined by about 80%, which is a really dramatic decline. But in his final year in office, Obama still oversaw a picture where you had over 30,000 troops left in that region. And that really dwarfs the scale of the overseas presence we saw in the pre-9/11 era. So I think Obama's record is something of a middle ground between his overstretched inheritance and the prescriptions of restraint scholars. He trimmed the excesses of the Bush era, but broadly left in place the foundations of that commitment.
What are the three pathways through which domestic pressures constrain strategic adjustment?
Well, the first pathway operates at the level of mass public opinion, where there is a degree of dissonance between, on one hand, the public's growing disillusionment with military primacy, and on the other hand, its considerable residual preoccupation with a really wide range of threats in the Middle East. So if you look at polling by organizations like the Institute for Global Affairs, they consistently show that the public is increasingly skeptical of large-scale military interventions. Most voters do not support an increase in defense spending and would prefer to decrease the number of troops stationed across the world. But at the same time, the public expresses considerable concern, if not alarm, about threats like international terrorism, about the threat posed by Iran. And the public often responds to images of shocking acts of violence and human rights abuses in the Middle East with a desire for its elected officials to do something, and often favoring the use of military tools to do that. Voters might not favor endless war, but they still have a long to-do list, and it's one that would require elected officials to maintain a considerable investment of military resources in the region. The second pathway looks at what all of this means for decision makers, and particularly political leaders who have to be sensitive to electoral pressures. Now, of course, presidents are the most important actor here. We can think of them as having dual responsibilities. On one hand, they're the commander-in-chief, so they've got to pursue military strategies that they perceive to be strategically optimal. But on the other hand, they're elected office holders, so they've got to try to minimize the political risks of any option they choose. And that dilemma, I think, means several things that cuts against a program of restraint, or at least historically has. It means that presidents face incentives to perpetuate involvement in conflicts out of fear of being blamed for having lost them or bungled the handling of that war. It also means presidents invest in the use of drones and other light footprint approaches that enable them to scratch the interventionist itch of an otherwise war-weary public. And in an era of intense political polarization, it also means that elected officials in Congress face very weak incentives to support the policies of the sitting president. All of that means it can be really difficult to sustain momentum for a coherent program of restraint in a way that's likely to endure beyond the next electoral cycle. The third pathway, very briefly, looks at civil-military relations and how senior military officers can operate as particularly powerful bureaucratic agents in ways that can often frustrate attempts to do less. Now, in theory, of course, the president has the right to choose any lawful policy they wish, and the military is obliged to obey. But in practice, there can be significant political costs associated with going against the advice of the generals. This is rooted in public attitudes about the military. The public expresses extraordinary levels of confidence in the armed forces. They want elected leaders to defer to the advice of senior military officials. And that gives military leaders considerable latent political weight, even when they behave in perfect accordance with their obligation to remain politically neutral. Now, there's no reason why the military should be pro or against a program of restraint, but the sheer size of CENTCOM as a bureaucratic institution gives it clout, which, if not handled correctly, can generate significant civil-military friction and slow down the implementation of presidential policies. So for each of these pathways, public opinion, electoral incentives, and civil-military relations, I look at data and draw on interviews with senior officials to illustrate how that all played out during the Obama administration.
Do you have any concluding thoughts you'd like to share before we go?
I think reasonable people can disagree about what the right strategy looks like going forward. But what I hope is that my research demonstrates that the success or the durability of any revised posture depends to a significant degree on the strength of its domestic foundations. As we revisit this debate about whether and how the US should scale back its commitment to the Middle East, I do think it's important to have an awareness of the political constraints under which decision makers are operating. And for those who advocate for a more restrained posture, I actually think it's time to move beyond slogans like ending endless war. This has been a really powerful political message in recent years, but it's prescriptively thin. It addresses the interventionism, but not the underlying infrastructure of the US commitment to the region. So I think a broader and more rhetorically appealing framework is required that helps the public understand the full implications of that approach. In general, the more that can be done to enrich public understanding about these policies, to really highlight the strategic trade-offs at stake, the more likely we are to be able to build a consensus that can be sustained in the long term.
We have a few extra minutes. If you'll indulge me, I have one more question for you.
Of course.
Why this article? Why did you write it now?
It's a very timely article, but it wasn't intended to be. My broader research looks at the domestic politics of US foreign policy. I'm essentially a historian masquerading as a political scientist, so I've done a lot of work looking at the wars in Korea, in Vietnam, and Iraq. And the more I got interested in it, the more I was very interested in the Middle East as a region. And I remember being told when I started this project about a year or so ago, why are you interested in the Middle East? The US is getting out of the Middle East. And the historian in me was okay with that, but the policy relevant side of my research was left a little bit uncertain. Of course, October 7th came along and made this research agenda a lot more salient. So it's a marriage between my interest in the history of foreign policy and domestic politics and being able to speak to contemporary events and interpret that.
Listeners, you can find the article at press.armywarcollege.edu/parameters. Look for Volume 54, Issue 1. For more War College podcasts, check out Conversations on Strategy, SSI Live, and A Better Peace. Andrew, this was a real pleasure. Thank you for making time to speak with me today.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed this episode of Decisive Point and would like to hear more, you can find us on any major podcast platform.